accession number 20303, reel 2.
John Goddard, reel 2.
Well, this meant we were the long-term serving sailors and we were the career sailors for the Navy. And when the Navy looked around for alternative establishment, they alighted on Cunningham's holiday camp, 2 miles outside Douglas on the Isle of Man. It was a splendid holiday camp. It was chalets. It was built on the side of a hill. And there were chalets, light wooden chalets, built just for summer use. And then there were marvellous ornamental gardens. And then you had this gorgeous dining room, a palm court, a dance hall that fitted ideally into becoming a boys' training establishment. Dining hall, naturally, what it was. The palm court was turned into offices, and this marvellous ballroom became the gymnasium or cinema, whatever you choose to use it for. There was also indoor swimming pool, and there was accommodation for the staff that became the chiefs and petty officers' mess. The officers lived out, and also the main road actually passed through Cunningham Holiday Camp, and the upper half where all the chalets were, there were huge playing fields up there. So again, it was ideal site for a boys' training establishment. And so the Navy took it over in 1940. The first thing they did was they asphalted the ornamental gardens, and that became a huge playground. So they were really set up then.
What did the Navy call it?
HMS St. George.
Can you tell me about what happened to you that day?
Well, the routine was, when you joined, you had 6 weeks new entry training, it was called. This was when you got issued with a uniform and your kit. Now, all items of kit, you had to, cloth kit, you had to sew your names in. White articles, you had to sew your name in black cotton. You had a stencil, a wooden block, that you dabbed on black ink, like pressed your underpants or pyjamas or whatever it is, and then you sewed in black cotton. Socks and navy blue jumpers, you did it white paint, and then you had red silk cotton. And so you spent 6 weeks sewing in all your spare time to put your name in your kit. This, of course, is, you know, stop stealing. Your boots, they were punched with your name, so you couldn't lose your boots. So your first impression was you joined the Navy to sew. But at the same time, you had an educational test. And this test was to assess you what branches you were going into. And once you joined, you could become a telegraphist or a signalman. This is reading flags and doing semaphore and Morse lamp. Or else you became a seaman. And the seamen, of course, are the men who fight the ship. These big, you know, torpedoes, gunnery, radar, those branches. But for seamen, you were, result of the educational test, you were graded whether to have advanced education. It was called advanced classes, and so you had a higher level of education whilst you were at St. George. Now, this happened, and also in new entry training, you were introduced to, if you'd never met it before, the basics of rifle drill and parade drill. And you also learned elementary seamanship, parts of a ship, knots and splices, and this sort of thing, an introduction.
Were you happy then?
Yes, I was quite happy, yeah.
And how long was the course?
Well, we're there for a year. Yeah, and it was very well done, because half the time, every day, the day was divided into half your day was spent at school, right? No, that's not quite true. Well, about half the day. And then just over a quarter of the day was spent on seamanship and naval training, gunnery training. And then the other quarter of the day was spent on sport. And so you did a sporting activity. So it was quite well worked out. And of course, we had cutters and whalers down in Douglas Harbour, where you went and did your sailing and rowing and those activities. And we had a marvellous bugle band that instilled a sense of pride. On Sundays, we were the Royal Naval School of Music. It's now the Royal Marine School of Music, but before the war, it was called the Royal Naval School of Music. That was also evacuated to the Isle of Man, and the holiday camp about 2 miles from us. And that is where the boy entrants joining the Royal Marines were trained. And a lot of our friends who had been with the Xmas were training to be boy musicians or Royal Marine musicians. And we all always had a Royal Marine band on Sundays, which was good. Yeah, he liked that sort of thing, the boy.
What were you aiming at yourself?
Well, having joined, well, I became a seaman. Mm-hmm. So you become a boy seaman, and then did all my training. Discipline was strict if you were stupid. I mean, one of the main things was smoking. I mean, if you're told not to smoke, I mean, there you are. If you're foolish enough to smoke, you get punished for it, because it's the rule, you know. And so, fortunately, I was never tempted to smoke, but 90% of punishments were to do with smoking. Yeah. I'll tell you one interesting story, though, here. Not many people know, because it's not in any of his biographies. Early in 1945, we heard of a boy, I was in the lower camp, and we heard of a boy in the upper camp that was causing a lot of trouble, and he was getting a lot of punishment. And there used to be at 5 o'clock, men on punishment, if you'd done anything wrong, you were required to get up early in the morning, early, before everybody else, and you did a half hour sort of scrubbing, domestic type job, sweeping round or something like that, before the rest of the boys got up. At lunchtime, where you'd have an hour's break, half hour for your lunch, half hour off, you were required to work that half hour. Come the evening, you had about a 2 hour break. You were then required to do extra work or drill if you were under punishment. Well, we heard of that, this one particular boy, and we used to turn out to watch this chap drilling, being forced to run round the playground with rifles. There'd be probably about 9 or 10 of them. We used to wear white duck suits in those days, and there'd be an instructor in charge, all of them to double and change arms and everything else like that. And this one particular boy, he was sort of bigger and more muscular than the rest. And we used to turn out to watch him. And the instructor would rest the other 7 or 8. And because this boy was being sort of, you know, a bit difficult, the instructor would keep him running. Well, it was Sean Connery, believe it or not. Sean Connery. And what had happened to Sean Connery was, he lived in Edinburgh, and he, you know, quite a rough area. And when he was 15, 16, he was used to going in pubs, used to having girlfriends, used to staying out what time he liked. When you join the Navy, you only went ashore once a week in the afternoon, 1 till 6. We only had 2 shillings a week pay. And it didn't take, and most of us had come from sheltered backgrounds, even a training ship, you know, we were disciplined and we had been rigorously sort of kept in check. And Sean Connery quickly realised he had made a mistake in joining the Navy. And he made up his mind he was going to get out. And he was going to do it the hard way, through indiscipline. And the Navy tried to break his spirit. This is what happened to him. And there came a stage when they'd given him all the sort of punishments they could, eligible for a boy. And so what they did next was, next time he did something wrong, right, they promoted him to an ordinary seaman. They put him in cells for a week of the punishment. When he came out, he was disrated to a boy seaman again. And the eventual end of this story is that when he was 19, the Navy couldn't give in, because it would have opened, once you created a precedent, the 12-year engagements and you're a boy seaman and you could get out. And this was the last thing the Navy or the government could allow to happen. And once you did that, and so what happened was, he actually went to sea, and when he was on an aircraft carrier called the Indomitable, he was invalided out through ill health. Now, Sean Connery, the reason I mentioned the duck suit and being 6'7", of course, he was a junior Mr. Universe. When he was in Edinburgh, he used to do all the bodybuilding, and he'd featured in these health and magazines. And he was a very muscular young man. And say, he was bigger than the rest of us. It was quite amazing. Yeah. Quite amazing. And so he was invalided out. Now, could you imagine Sean Connery being in fit for the Navy at 19? There we are.
So it was just a pretext.
This is how the compromise that was reached.
But did you know him? Did you speak?
No, he was in the upper camp. And so he wasn't in my class. You tended to know people in your class or in your division. You had these rows of huts, and there'd be 24 in a class, and then you'd be four boys per hut. So obviously you knew those, and there were the Hawk Division, Drake Division, and about 100 boys in each. And so you tended to know your group near you, and he was upper camp. So I didn't actually know him, no.
But how did you know all these details, like he wanted to get home?
Well, we just discussed amongst ourselves, because it was known by chaps who were in his cabin. Mm. Yeah.
What was your attitude and that of your friends towards him?
Well, we were just absolutely amazed that he had the guts to stand up to all this. Yeah, we're absolutely amazed. Because by and large, see, we were pretty cowed, because the Navy had you. I mean, there was no freedom. You didn't have a life of your own. I mean, the Naval Discipline Act was so strict. I mean, you say you were 5 minutes adrift off leave. You went before the commander, and the charge would be read. And then they would say, and according to the Admiralty instructions, you may suffer any punishment here and after mentioned, including death. You see, including death. I was only 5 minutes late offshore. This is the way the sort of Navy ran. Yes.
What happened to you next?
Right. Well, next, we had VJ Day came. The biggest disappointment of my life, because it meant the war was over. And I wasn't going to see to take part and be a boy Cornwall and die at my gun and get a VC and all this business. And anyway... in September 1945, I went to sea. My class went to sea. We bought an aircraft carrier, been converted to trooping then, and went out to Australia. And arrived at Fremantle on Christmas Day 1945. And then went to Sydney, went into barracks, and then I joined a battleship in the January called HMS Anson.
What impression did that ship make on you first?
It was absolutely amazing. I mean, to climb this gangway onto this huge ship, this great big quarter deck, it was absolutely amazing. Everything's spotlessly clean and so efficient. And interestingly enough, we'd only been on there about a fortnight when the first Sydney to Hobart sailing race, this was in January 1946, was held. And the battleship King George V acted as guard ship to the yachts going down and took the Duke and Duchess of Gloucester, he was the Governor General of Australia. They were on board and went to Hobart. And then about 10 days later, the KG5 had left after a few days. The Anson, we sailed down to Hobart and we picked up the Duke and Duchess of Gloucester and walked them back to Sydney. And from there, we went up to Japan. And we became part of the Japanese occupation forces.
Can you tell me about that, please?
Well, that was amazing, really, because there were zones in Japan, occupation zones, British and American, and the British zone was centred on a port called Kure. And Kure was on a bay, on Hiroshima Bay. And about 15 miles across the bay was Hiroshima. So within 6 months of the bomb dropping, we actually went across to visit Hiroshima, which was an incredible experience. I mean, just completely flattened. They'd bulldozed some roads, you know, cleared some roads through, maybe two in each direction. And then there were just a few buildings half standing, the ones that had steel girders in. Absolutely incredible to see this vast plain, this ruined city there. Yeah, it's amazing. And the Japanese themselves, I mean, they were virtually starving. We used to have what we call a rubbish chute on the side of the ship where we used to dispose of all our waste down this chute into the sea. And after mealtime, what we call the cooks of the mess would take the garbage up and tip it down the chute. And there would be about 17 or 18 sampans waiting around the chute. And the Japanese would have nets, and they would be netting in potato peelings, pieces of the bread, anything that was floating like that. And they would net it. And they would have their different little pots in the boat, and they would put potato peelings in one, they put bread in another, anything that looked like meat in another one. It was quite incredible. And the same ashore, you know, they were absolutely destitute.
What was your attitude towards the Japanese civilians?
Well, with no real feeling one way or the other. I mean, it was such a sudden change where the Japanese had been the hated enemy and the atrocities. Of course, when you got there, that feeling had sort of gone up somehow. I mean, you just lost it. When you went ashore, you know, the Japanese themselves were very friendly and very nice people.
Were there ever any incidents
no,
with the Japanese?
No, no. Because they're very, I suppose this is the Japanese characteristic, they're very subservient. And the emperor had been kept in power by MacArthur, of course. And the government told him what had happened and cooperate with the occupation forces. And they were marvellous, really. We were taken on trips. Boys were very fortunate. The Navy was very paternal to world's boys. For example, you didn't get all your pay. I mean, my pay at this time was about 9 shillings a week, of which I only got 3 shillings. The rest was banked for you. And the reason you only got 3 shillings was because if you had too much money, you went ashore. I mean, it'd be so easy to think you're a big grown-up sailor, go in a bar and get something to drink or something stupid. And so they looked after you this way. You didn't get much leave. You had to be back on board, dependent on ships, either 7 o'clock in the evening or 9 o'clock in the evening. It depended on the commander of the ship. Again, so you weren't out late at night, and so you couldn't be do anything stupid. And so it was very, very paternal. Also, at the same time, you were under the care of the parson and the school teacher. And when you went anywhere, they would organise trips for you, coach trips. You know, we were taken off to monasteries and temples and things like that. And we saw, again, meeting the Japanese, went to these out-of-the-way places, really. We went to some places they hadn't seen a European. An occupation force, you know. And went to these little Japanese tea ceremonies. We would all be sitting around drinking this green tea. So it was quite an experience.
Were the boys a target for homosexuality?
Never met it. This talk about homosexuality never occurred, never cropped up at all. Again, this is what you were, again, paternal. When you, boys were only sent to big ships, aircraft carriers, cruisers, and battleships. You were always accommodated by yourself in your own, in boys' messes. And you always had instructors, petty officers or chief petty officer instructors who looked after you. Right. And you also, because you're on the big ships, there was all the priests on the ships and there was all, also schoolmasters. And you continue to attend school as well and pass your professional examinations. Yeah, it was quite an amazing setup, really.
What were your own duties aboard Anson?
Well, again, when you're on big boys as a boy, until you were 18, or if you got accelerated advancement, it could be 17 and a half, you weren't allowed to keep watches after 9 o'clock at night. This was even in wartime on battleships. And my duty was what's called side boy. Now, you've got the gangway on the quarterdeck, and that was always manned by what's called the quartermaster, which would be the chief of petty officer, a boatswain's mate. He's the man who piped the messages that you hear broadcast on the ship, or on the ERAM messages, and a Royal Marine bugler. This is when dignitaries came on board, and over a ship pass, you had a standstill with a Royal Marine bugler, and there'd be a side boy. Now, the side boy's duty was, when you were actually on watch, you had to be immaculate, of course, you ran the messages. You know, somebody came on board and you had to send them guns. Say, go and tell the captain, such as, you know, a boat's approaching the ship or something like that. So you would run these sort of messages. And then during the morning, if you weren't actually on watch, you then looked at, you scrubbed the gangways and kept the quarterdeck area. So that was my job. I was called a side boy because you manned the side.
Were you happy in the ship?
Oh, yeah. It was a marvelous life. See? I mean, it was, lots of friends. You were used to a modest life. I mean, you didn't have any needs. You didn't know any different. Yeah. But I must say, there was one change occurred to that. When, it must have been about in the March 1946 now, they held a victory parade in Tokyo. And we sailed to take part in this. So we left Kure and we went to Yokohama. And we had the band of the Cameron Highlanders. They were the lead, the British detachment. And that was marvellous. We sailed through the Inland Sea of Japan. And I think it was two evenings we were going through. They put on a concert display on the quarterdeck. It was absolutely marvellous. Sailing through the Inland Sea of Japan, which is beautiful. You can see the banks, you know, in many places each side. And in the evening, it was absolutely marvellous. And of course, we had our own Royal Marine Band as well. And anyway, we got to Tokyo, and, well, we got to Yokohama, rather. And, well, the facilities ashore for the British, and our little British enclosure, was a canteen. Now, when our sailors went ashore, as boys, we didn't qualify for beer tickets. We wouldn't have bought it anyway, because we wouldn't have liked the stuff. We wouldn't waste our money on it, because we could buy sweets or something in the canteen. But they were given two beer tickets to go and have two pints of beer in the canteen. Now, actually, the glasses in the canteen were beer bottles ground down at the top to make glasses. That was all we had in the British part of Yokohama. We went to, caught the train, you know, on shore leave up to Tokyo. Well, the Americans had these marvellous clubs there. There was one club in this hotel. It was called the Ernie Pyle Theatre. And I found out since that Ernie Pyle was a very famous American news reporter in the Pacific. Well, this club When you walked in the cafeteria, or they had these marvellous meals that the Americans lay on, it was all free. Oh, and you imagine young boys, free food. It was all free. They had Coca-Cola, free. Then they had this sort of sitting out area. They had hundreds of paper books, paperback books, novels, all free. You could help yourself. And then they had a bar area. And in an evening, they had a 12-piece Japanese dance band playing. And the contrast was amazing. And this, as a youngster, you couldn't help realize what a difference the wealth of the Americans compared to, you know, the way we had been impoverished, really. It was quite amazing, yeah. Anyway, we did the victory parade, the march for Tokyo, and our Army band, the Cameron Highlands. That's splendid.
And then?
Well, then we came home, went to Singapore. That was rather nice because in the Navy, of course, sailors normally store a ship. You know, you're humping boxes and sacks of spuds on board. But we didn't do that in Singapore because the Japanese prisoner of war did it for us. There's still Japanese prisoner of war did that for us. And then we came back home. We arrived on July the 20th, 1946, at Portsmouth.
Did you leave the ship?
No, I didn't leave the ship then, because the reason being that the Navy in common with the other services obviously had to demobilize all the hostility into ratings. So there was a big demobilization of the Navy, but we still had to keep a reasonable fleet in being, of course. And it was just, they had to have a crash program of training, recruiting and training sailors. And so they decided, because there weren't enough barracks, they would send some big ships down to Portland. And in fact, they sent four battleships, Nelson, the Rodney, the Anson, and the Howe, to Portland, and converted some of the messes into classrooms. And then they recruited sailors on what's called a 7 and 5 engagement. This is when they joined as adult ratings. So they were 17, 18 when they joined. And they had to do 7 years in the fleet. And then when they were 25, they could then leave the Navy and serve 5 years on reserve. And there was this big throughput to replace, of course they didn't have to replace all of them, but there was a big rundown that they had to hurriedly do this. And then in the end, they even brought a carrier down, the Implacable, I remember, to do this. And so they were known as the Portland Training Squadron. And so I was on, stayed on her for another year, doing this job.
What was it like in Portland?
Well, it was rather boring, actually, Portland. Weymouth is a very nice town, mainly in the summer, of course. But other than that, I mean, really, you just waited for a weekend leave so you could go home for the weekend.
So what was your next step?
Well, my next step was, I was then just a seaman. And I was now an ordinary seaman. I'd gone from boy seaman. I got what they call accelerated advancement, became an ordinary seaman at 17 and a half. But when you're a seaman, you have to specialise in gunnery, torpedoes, radar, surveying recorder or whatever. And so it was the Navy changed the way its branches were formed, and torpedomen had always done electrical work, but they decided to form an electrical branch. They decided to form a torpedo and anti-submarine branch, and also the telegraphers branch. You either were an operator or you became a maintainer.